previously on the Kunstler Cast.
In America, we should change our national motto from "In God We Trust" to "It's the thought that counts," or "We meant to." You know, because you know, American life is so full of empty gestures. And we see so many empty gestures in the built environment, you know, including the sidewalks that end after 60 feet. And, you know, there are so many things like that.
You're listening to the Kunstler Cast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl, featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. I'm Duncan Crary. Today's topic is private property and the common good. Hey, Jim, it's always great to see you again in the Kunstler Cave.
Nice to see your smiling face, Duncan.
I have a very thoughtful, but a very long question that came to us from a listener on our discussion forum. I think this is actually worth the time, though, so I'm going to read it out loud to you right now, okay?
Okay.
And the username is, I think, M. Healy. I don't know how you pronounce it. I'm a longtime reader and listener of Jim. My first and favorite book of his I read was The City in Mind. I've come to realize that the problem may not be suburban sprawl or easy motoring or the search for convenience that is wrecking the landscape. Maybe those are all just symptoms. When we remember what happened with America's industrial cities, and we think back of the opinions people had of American cities in the late and early 19th century, the fact is that there is no real successful American model of complex urban life. I see the issue of urban sprawl as just one aspect of the general problem of urban corruption, meaning that the city authorities are not capable of solving the problems they are tasked with solving. Sprawl is just the default state of this corruption problem, in that it has the advantages of being wonderfully lazy to apply. If you're the part-time mayor of some unassuming suburban town, all you need to do is install a zoning ordinance you bought from the Municode and then instruct your engineers to build six-lane car conduits at regular intervals. If you're Houston, you don't even bother with the zoning ordinance. If you do anything more ambitious than that, your voters are going to complain nonstop, so why bother? In one podcast, I think the one on pavement, Jim says that there is an amazing level of agreement in Europe over what cities should be. There is this idea in Europe that a city is more of a public service than what Americans call local government. Cities aren't out to govern people, but to produce urbanity. I think the difference between American and European perspective is likely rooted in the pre-industrial forms of land ownership. In Europe, cities were owned by the nobility as their own land. And they ran them and regulated them and even bought and sold them on markets. Even the big renovation of Paris was initiated by an emperor. Europeans, therefore, have this idea of the city as this external agent that they have to deal with, and they expect a certain amount of services from. My favorite example for a comparison is Berlin versus Detroit. Berlin is Europe's best-made industrial city, because it had relatively no existence before capitalism and the Industrial Revolution. Then in the 20th century, it was bombed to ashes and split in the middle by a wall, half of which suffered under socialism, and the other half encircled by it. Even today, it has a shrinking population and a weak economy. But when you go there, things work. The trains and subways are top-notch. The streets are clean, and the pre-war neighborhoods kept intact in East Berlin are gentrifying. The city authorities are actively involved in developing it, even if it might shrink. Now, what of Detroit? It wasn't bombed. It wasn't walled in. Why didn't the city authorities develop it better? I'm wondering if you could do a KunstlerCast episode on the topic of local authority, incorporation, and community ownership, how it may evolve in our lifetimes, and how it should evolve. We all agree that suburban sprawl can't go on, but unless there's also an evolution in the institutions that made it happen, it won't be replaced by nice small towns, but it will be an outright collapse. Okay, Jim, that was a rather lengthy, but I think a thoughtful post.
Very thoughtful, and a lot of things to address. When you travel to Europe as an American, you can't fail to notice a couple of things. One is that they clearly value the experience of city life. You know, they value it as a habitat for dwelling in, for being in. It's not a punishment to be to live in Paris or Barcelona. They never lost the idea that city life per se had value. They have rebuilt their cities following the Second World War, at least the ones that were damaged, to be better than ever in some ways. They also have excellent public transit to an extent that that is almost supernatural to us living in here in the States. But they raise some interesting things. One is the whole property ownership issue. Here in America, we have a pretty straightforward system called fee simple ownership. And it basically means you pay for your land with money, you get a title and a deed, and you are the owner. In many, if not most, of the European nations, places, former duchies, and principalities, you had generally a situation where the crown, in one way or another, owned the property, and all sales or transmissions of that property subsequent to that were just elaborate rental agreements in one way or another, really, when you cut away all the crap. But ultimately, there was always some higher authority just below God who could tell you what to do with your land. Now, I have to insert here that there's a relatively new idea in America, and it's pretty much a fallacy, that that Americans have a tradition of being able to do whatever they want with their land, and that any impediments placed against that are somehow un-American. This is a fallacy. It's really been the result of a propaganda campaign from the promoters of suburban sprawl and the real estate industry, who have been fighting against any kind of regulation. You know, we actually have a long history and a fat body of law for land use and the regulation of things that you can do on it and with it. And, you know, there is a whole corpus of responsibilities, obligations, and duties that come with land ownership that simply can't be ignored. This all falls under the law, and we can indeed tell people what to do with their land. Now, there's a further problem in recent decades in our lifetime, and a little beyond it, actually. You know, the fact that we developed this set of behaviors and these patterns of activity that we call suburban sprawl. And they're behaviors in the sense that they make up a set of customs and practices that enable certain things to happen. And the activities like developing suburban cul-de-sac subdivisions or strip malls, you know, these are the things that take place within that context. And we're very comfortable with it. It has created a lot of wealth. And it did it primarily by taking advantage of this new thing that we created in the 1950s called the Interstate Highway System. And all this was a large company. This was a large country that was connected up by that network, and there was a great deal of then undeveloped land lying out there. And we had our own oil supply for many years. We were the leading oil producer in the world during the 1950s and 60s, and we took full advantage of it. And we embarked on this suburban adventure. All kinds of people benefited from it. We got the idea that there was no problem with it until all of a sudden now we're kind of banging our heads against the wall of limits. But even so, we haven't quite discovered that there's a problem with the whole suburban thing. And this is despite many of the shortcomings of suburbia in its own right, apart from any of the energy problems that it presents. This is a set of behaviors that we just don't want to give up, and customs and habits that became entrenched, and investments that were made that people now want to defend. I actually think we're going back to a kind of disposition of things in which there's a more distinct sense of being either in the urban environment or the rural environment, and that the rural things will take place in the rural places. You know, farming, agriculture, production of food and stuff like that. and that if you want to lead a city life, you'll be in a city. One of the features of suburbia was that it allowed an awful lot of people to lead urban lives in a rural setting, or to constantly cross that frontier from one to the other. And that is going to increasingly not be possible for people.
Well, Jim, speaking about Europe, the only place in Europe I've actually been is the United Kingdom and Ireland. But I did have some observations. One thing that made me kind of chuckle was here in New York State, we have the Adirondack Park. We call it a park, but it's this patchwork of private and public land. We've mentioned it before on the show. You know, in Scotland, where I spent most of my time, Scotland just looks like the Adirondack Park. I mean, there's little villages and then there's wide open expanses that you can walk through. They don't call it a park. That's just the landscape.
Yeah, there are parts of the United Kingdom that are highly suburbanized in a very sad way. You know, if you go to someplace like Oxfordshire or, you know, for that matter, the outlands of London. And there are some of them which sometimes eerily resemble parts of the United States. But for the most part, you know, once you get far enough from London and go north, I think you see a traditional landscape, which is composed of urban habitats at every scale. And you know, the habitat is still an urban habitat, but it exists at the village or the town or the small city or the large city.
Yeah.
But there's a sharp distinction between what is a town and what is a country.
Right. And you sort of get that in the Adirondack Park because it's the rest of the outlying land is regulated by an authority. It's
like the towns in the Adirondacks actually do have their smudgy suburban edges. So
yeah.
I would say actually that our efforts in the Adirondacks have been signally unsuccessful in regulating that kind of outcome, and very disappointing when you see, you know, this zone of smarmy suburban strip crap between Lake Placid and Saranac Lake. You know, it's pretty dispiriting. You know, why couldn't they regulate that better? You know, the answer is goes back to what I said before, is that these habits and practices are so thoroughly entrenched now that nobody knows how to do it any differently. Nobody knows how to deliver a drugstore in a form other than a UFO in a parking lagoon.
Well, and getting back to Europe and the sprawl, I mean, I came crashing down from the Highlands into Inverness, and I landed in a suburban cul-de-sac. It was pretty awful. It was very jarring. But here's another observation I had. I was in the west of Scotland, and I was in the Hebridean Islands, and it had been explained to me that although there's private property here, the way that trespassing laws work, you can walk across anyone's farm. They can ask you to leave their land, but you can keep coming back. You see what I mean? Like that was the way they had it arranged. You would probably respect someone's wishes to not go on their land, but you know, it's not like they have posted signs everywhere.
They also have established a rights of way for hiking trails and walking paths.
Oh, sure. And I'm just talking about walking through someone's farmland
or
whatever.
Sure.
And, you know, they do have signs pretty emphatically telling you to lock the gate so the sheep don't get out. But otherwise, you can pretty much just walk onto someone's land. Now, there's cranky people who will yell at you, but for the most part, you can just walk there. Now, I was with some youngsters who were giving me a tour of this island, Lismore in the Hebrides, and we took a barge from Oban across the water to this Isle of Lismore, and we rode our bikes across someone's farm, and we had lunch on a 2,000-year-old Pictish brock, which is like a stone structure that people lived in. And that's when it kind of dawned on me that if you have this evidence of people who've been using this land for thousands of years and it's surrounding you, the thought of putting posted signs and telling people to keep off private property is kind of absurd. You know, it's in your face. Like,
well, this is an absurd society that we live in, and just because we do a certain thing now and we follow certain practices now doesn't mean that we're going to continue them, you know, for 50 or 100 or 300 more years.
Yeah. But you see what I'm saying, though? When you're faced with the evidence that my life is just a drop in the bucket, and how could I possibly proclaim this my private property? It's silly.
Well, when all is said and done, all of our ownership of everything in this world is an elaborate form of rental, because as Hank Williams once said, no matter how much I struggle and strive, I'll never get out of this world alive. So it's kind of a conceit that we're the proprietors of these things.
I find it fascinating the Hudson Valley of New York State was existing in basically a feudalistic state until the Civil War. There were these large land tracts that were called patroonships, and they were started by the Dutch, but this practice was continued by the English after they conquered New York State as like a reward system to supporters of the crown, etc. But essentially, you have a system of feudalism where these tenant farmers are paying rent in forever. You know, they never own their land. It always belongs to the patroon. And if they sell it, they have to slice into that sale price. It's feudalism.
Well, it doesn't exist anymore.
No, it was ended during the Civil War, basically. Mm-hmm. It's amazing it lasted that long. Mm-hmm. But anyway, here's my thought on this. Vincent Price's first leading role was in a movie called Dragonwyck, or Dragonvike, if you want to pronounce it correctly. And he plays a Hudson River patroon. I forget his name, but he's kind of evil. And his tenants revolt, as they did actually in real life in the Helderbergs during the Tin Horn Rebellion. Mm-hmm. And Vincent Price is giving this talk to his tenant peasant farmers, basically saying, "Fine, go ahead. You want your independence? Fine, but good luck bargaining. You know, good luck selling your crops. I own the mill." You know, where you grind your wheat. I own the port, you know, where you ship your goods to, and I collectively bargain for you. So good luck.
Actually, you know, in my own book, my recent novel, World Made by Hand, one of the characters is a guy, Mr. Bullock, who is sort of recreating the patroonship on his own. Why? Because he can. Because he's a farmer who's acquired hundreds and hundreds of acres surrounding him, and has attracted people who have lost their incomes and occupations to live on his property in a little village that he creates for them. And, you know, it's conceivable that we may actually find ourselves in a situation where, you know, we have kind of a class arrangement where people sell their personal sovereignty for food security and security generally. We don't know yet how this is going to shake out.
Well, but I was thinking when I read the book and I watched the movie, I forget if that scene I'm describing.
The Vincent Price movie.
Dragonwyck.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also a book. But when I encountered that scene, I was thinking, you know, there are still some farms left in the Hudson Valley. They're pretty small, but they didn't really succeed. And I'm sure there's a lot of factors. But a major factor would be the ability to collectively bargain on behalf of all these farmers. I mean, you lose a lot when you can't collectively sell all these goods.
Well, yes. And you know, you get... you go through these periods of history where you have social relations that are pretty discouraging. I'm not quite sure what to say about that. You know, I'm not sure that we have permanently evolved out of any of these things. We have to remember that our experience in our time and in the last 200 years has been kind of an anomaly in human history. The cheap energy adventure and a lot of the social forms or social arrangements that we've enjoyed may not persist, especially the extraordinary equality that existed in the late 20th century in the United States. You know, we may find ourselves being in a much more hierarchical society in the future. I personally think that we will be for various reasons. And one of the things I've been thinking lately, as we get into trouble with food production and the whole agricultural system based on cheap oil and all of the things we get from it, you know, the pesticides and fertilizers, you know, we're going to have to change radically the way we've been farming and producing our food. And there's probably going to be a big fight over the reallocation of land for productive purposes, you know, locally. And we have no idea how we're going to settle this. It's further complicated by the way, the things that we've allowed to be built on good agricultural land, you know, chopping it up and creating smaller and smaller viable kinds of places that can be reused as farms. I think there's going to be a big issue in the years ahead, and that those people who do retain land with high agricultural productivity potential, you know, those people are going to be very wealthy. And they're probably going to generate a lot of resentment from the people who have less and less income and less ability to keep going. People who have lost their jobs and their roles in the economy.
Well, Jim, our listener was asking about local authority and corporation and community ownership, and I found a quote from Barack Obama when he was a senator that set my wheel spinning. This was on WBEZ radio. And Obama said, generally, the Constitution is a charter of negative liberties, says what the states can't do to you, says what the federal government can't do to you. But it doesn't say what the federal government or the state government must do on your behalf. I thought that was an intriguing statement. And I was thinking about it in relationship to this topic. What is the federal and state government going to do about ownership of land and using it for community purposes?
Well, it's an interesting question and maybe a good question. I don't think that we're going to change contract law, you know, as far as it exists right now. Where, you know, I don't see any particular movement away from the fee simple form of land tenure. You know, we don't have a king or a duke here in upstate New York, and so that ain't going to happen. But we may evolve into a much different notion of what our duties and obligations are to our fellow citizens where land use is concerned, especially as people start to go hungry.
Now that we're going to be owning all these suburban houses that are worthless, do you think the federal government might step in and start plowing down some of these houses and activating the agricultural land, putting them in a position of owning all that stuff?
I doubt that we're going to see something like that. I think more likely it'll be a much slower process of people simply using these suburban subdivisions as salvage operations to get materials that we won't be able to manufacture anymore for one reason or another. Either the resources are too scarce or the amount of energy necessary to make them will present a problem.
Yeah. Well,
but, no, I don't see the federal government going in on any wholesale basis and, you know, buying, you know, wholesale lots of suburban houses and converting them into cornfields. I don't see that happening. I think it's going to be a much messier and disorderly process and not something that any large government will rationalize. And, you know, I have to say this is consistent with my idea that big government is going to become less effective and more impotent as we move deeper into the long emergency.
But Jim, aren't we going to end up owning an awful lot of houses out in suburbia after all this bailout?
No, I don't believe that we are. I think we're going to discover that it's going to be very, very difficult for the government to acquire a lot of these places because we don't even know where the mortgages are. You know, I think it's much more likely that we're going to get into a situation where these houses are occupied by squatters, you know, people who no longer own them in any formal sense, but who just happen to be there until you can shove them out. And I'm not sure who does shove them out. It's going to take an awful long time to sort out this mortgage mess. And it has to do with the further ramifications and unintended consequences of the securitization of mortgages, which has been a huge fiasco.
Okay, Jim, so to wrap this up, I have a question about how do you motivate people to be more mindful of community benefit and the benefits of community land? I mean, I see in small cities they have community gardens now that are becoming very popular, but how do you shift Americans away from this attitude that I can do whatever I want with my land?
I don't know that any person or entity or institution is going to do that. I think it'll be a process, if it happens at all, that will happen naturally as circumstances force us to downscale what we do, live more locally, and work shoulder to shoulder with the people who are around us. And then we would naturally be compelled to take their needs and feelings into account. But until that point, you know, we're liable to behave the way we're programmed to behave. We're going to carry forward. Look, something that I've noticed in over the years myself is the phenomenal persistence of culture, and that includes behavior. And, you know, we keep on doing things a certain way, and we're going to continue long past the point where it's necessarily the wise thing to do, or even if it has any economic meaning anymore. You know, I'm even convinced that you're going to continue to see people build strip malls here and there, not too many, but here and there, despite the fact that, it's obvious that this is no longer a way to conduct commerce. But that's all we know how to do, so we'll keep on doing it.
Well, Jim, it's always a pleasure. I will, I'll see you soon.
Okay, on that note, farewell.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, download episodes of this program, read transcripts, learn about our theme music, join our mailing list, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Gebhardt?
Yes, man, here.
Empty-handed, too. Have you a reason?
You know the reason. It's his birthright as a free citizen. These men are not alone. The anti-rent movement has swept the whole of New York State. Take your head out of the sand, Van Ryn, and help solve this problem peacefully. Because it's got to be solved peacefully or not.
Well, speak up, Otto.
I'll bring the rent in tribute tomorrow if that will suit.
Tomorrow, then. Will the rest of you men step forward, please? I have something to say.
No, man, no! I'm tired of listening and talking. I say it is, and it's here and now.
Drop that knife, Bleaker.
I'll kill him.
It is about poor Bleaker York. Well, Dr. Turner, I suppose I must regard what you just did as an effort to save my life.
Klaus lost his head. None of us means violence.
Dirk, you will have Klaus Bleaker placed under arrest. As for you, Doctor, I suppose I must thank you.
If Klaus had killed you, it would have done these men infinitely more harm than you can ever do alive. Don't thank me.
As you wish it. I shall say a few words about what has just happened, and they will be my last. Dr. Turner's efforts to incite anti-rent rebellion have been well known to me for many months now. Believe me, gentlemen, my welfare does not depend upon you. Rather, you depend upon it. But my rents and tributes and my responsibilities are hereditary, the symbols of a way of life to which I have been born and in which I shall continue to live. I shall never relinquish my position. I will be here tomorrow, and so will you, with rent and tribute.